Hello and welcome to another edition of The Provocateur, the podcast for groundbreaking ideas from emerging thinkers. With me, Gal Kedo. You can access all the previous episodes on the website provocateurpodcast.com. This week, or today even, we are doing another instalment of our mini-series on to coincide with LGBT History Month on LGBT topics. And today we're having a little excursion into contemporary China and the discourses of marriage and sexuality that preoccupy men who have sex with men in contemporary China, and how that influences the way in which they construct their sexual identities. So joining me today to discuss the discourses of marriage and sexuality in contemporary China among gay and bisexual men, I'm joined by Philip Priestin, who is a doctoral candidate in linguistics at University of Reading. Phil, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
So, tell me, how did you get interested in the topic?
I've been living and working in China and Hong Kong for the last 7 years or so before coming back to England. And yeah, it fascinated me, the way that young Chinese gay men have to negotiate the complexities of marriage and culture. So the weight of tradition in China is particularly strong, and that really has an effect on the day-to-day life of people in the age bracket that where marriage becomes relevant. So we're talking about people from 25 to 30 who are thinking about marriage and coming under pressure from family and society to be married.
By marriage, I take it you mean heterosexual marriage?
Yes, so obviously where family and societal pressure is concerned, it's a heteronormative model that's being expressed, that people are put under pressure by, yeah.
And is it the case that it's mostly 25 to 30-year-olds? You don't get, for example, people who are, or young men who are 18, 19, 20, who want to get married?
Oh, for sure. I'm sure there are people who get married younger than that. I guess my experience and the reason I got interested in this was because I met a lot of people in the 25 to 30 bracket who... my research doesn't cover people younger than that, but I'm sure there are people who get married early, and I'm sure there are gay men in China who have issues about marriage from a very early age, because it's such a salient cultural feature in Chinese cultures. The idea of marriage and the obligation and the expectation of marriage is very much in people's conscience from a very early age, I think.
Could you just explain the cultural differences for our listeners between the kind of the Chinese conception of marriage and how we might typically think of marriage in Western liberal democracies?
Well, I think perhaps the crucial difference is when we look at collectivism and individualism, the underlying cultural tendencies that differentiate those two cultures, those two types of cultures. It's more likely that people in the West have more space in the marriage for their own individual visions and their own individual lifestyles and their own individual ideas. I think from what I understand from my limited time in China and Hong Kong, it's much more likely in a Chinese context that you are much more dedicated to the whole, the collective, in the sense that not only the family, but the society as a whole has a much more key role in your day-to-day life, and that affects things like marriage too. So, for example, you may sacrifice some of your individual desires and your individual plans in life, perhaps, for the benefit of your family, or even for the benefit of the larger group, which may be national or cultural. So I think the crucial difference between the West and Chinese cultures in terms of marriage is that there's less space for individuality.
And do you see that sort of dynamic playing out in Hong Kong and Macau and Taiwan as well? In the places where Western kind of liberal institutions have become more entrenched?
Right. I think that's an important question for sure. It's not one that I deal with in my research because I'm squarely focused on mainland China. However, I have limited experience of Hong Kong, having worked there for a few years, and I think the difference is noticeable, even in when you compare mainland China with Hong Kong, in the sense that obviously as an ex-colony there is a much stronger prominence of globalization and Western ideas in Hong Kong than there is in mainland China in general, and marriage of course is one of those. So I think the way that Hong Kongers think about marriage is perhaps more influenced by global trends and by Western ideas than it is in mainland China. Having said that, I also think the underlying power of Chinese tradition in Hong Kong is still massively significant. And when you take young gay men as an example, the fact that they're an ex-colony and that they have more exposure to global ideas perhaps than some sections of mainland Chinese society, they still have significant struggles when it comes to sexuality, if they happen to be a non-normative sexuality group, from a non-normative sexuality group, or with regard to marriage, in the sense that they have to deal with the same issues really that those in mainland China have to, which are the weight of Chinese tradition, Chinese writ large.
So you talk about the kind of cultural expectations that are placed on non-heterosexual men in mainland China. Is that largely a Confucian inheritance?
Well, I think the influence of philosophy is important in all cultural traditions, but I think the particular influence of Confucius is particularly important in Chinese cultures. I think Confucian ideals sort of trickle down to everyday life in a way that perhaps, you know, we can't really find a cultural alternative in the West where there's one specific philosopher who's had so much influence, I think, on everyday life. So, yeah, when it comes to marriage, I think Confucian ideals like filial piety and like the importance of kinship and the importance of the family in general definitely affect the way that young people think about family and therefore about marriage and also about sexuality and sex life by extension. Yeah.
Do you see any role for Buddhist influences or other non-Confucian influences?
Again, the religious side of things is something I haven't done much research on and I'd like to know more about, but I think that the interesting thing for me when I was living in China with regard to Buddhism is that it takes on a very different role to Buddhism in other states and Christianity in the West, in the sense that I don't feel like it has such a prominent influence on the day-to-day life of people in terms of their ideas and the way they do things. The way a Chinese person visits a temple for me seems different from the way that a Thai person visits a temple, because it's less involved in the fabric of their culture, if you like. It seems to me that the religious element of Chinese life has dissipated to some extent over history.
And become secularized, I suppose, as a result of Maoism and so on and so forth.
Absolutely, yeah. I think the ideas of Mao, I couldn't quote, but something along the lines of smashing all religion, surely is going to have an effect on the cultural importance of Buddhism in China.
And of course Mao had a sort of antipathy towards Confucianism, and yet Confucianism is still very prevalent in Chinese values. There seems to be this kind of tension between Maoist ideals and Confucian ideals. And do you also see that in the way that Chinese people conceptualize marriage?
Well, yeah, I think that's a very good point, in the sense that Confucianism is very prominent today, and it kind of doesn't seem to make sense that doesn't fit with the communist ideals that were around in Mao's time. But I think the modern day Chinese Communist Party has kind of taken Confucianism as something they want to support and promote, which they haven't done with Buddhism. So I think, you know, Confucianism still remains important. When it comes to marriage, I think the difference between the influence of Maoist thought and Confucianist thought for me is that In Confucianist thought, the importance of the family is key, and filial piety is key. What happened during Mao's time, I think, was an absolute desexualization, whereby marriage and kinship still were important, but anything outside of that, so any kind of sexual activity or any expression of desire, was suppressed during the time of the Cultural Revolution, for sure, and probably having an effect for a long time after that. So I think these are the kind of things that I'm interested in my research, really. I mean, how lasting the effects of traditions like the Cultural Revolution, in terms of how people think about themselves and about their sexuality and what they should or shouldn't do, or what they can or can't do, in terms of how they're seen by their family, by society, and by everyone around them in general.
And do you see a generational divide as well between those who grew up during the Cultural Revolution and those who grew up during the time of economic liberalisation?
Well, I would like to meet more people from the older generation and talk to them about that. Hopefully that'll be something I get to do perhaps in a few years after I've done my PhD and I'm doing other kind of research. But from what I know in my limited experience through talking to the younger people who have parents from that generation, there's a massive gap. And it was kind of mind-blowing for me, really, to be close to gay men in China and start to understand just how different their worldview was to that of their parents. Depending, of course, on their parents' cultural background and economic background, because I think perhaps the ideas of the Cultural Revolution have stayed, have more staying power in the context of a sort of more lower socioeconomic background groups. But either way, whether you're from a privileged group or from a lower socioeconomic group, the age gap, the generation gap, seems to be huge from what young people have said to me. The idea of, for example, coming out and telling your parents about the fact that you're interested in people of the same sex, just didn't really register with some of the people I spoke to in China, in the sense that it obviously they knew about that idea, but they didn't think it was even within the frame of their parents' thinking, and therefore it wasn't even worth considering, because they're just from such a different time and such a different background. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. That's just something that, you know, participants in studies have told me, and you know, obviously individual variations is important there, and the way that stories are told is important, but it seems to me that there's a huge generational difference, and that I think the opening up of China has really changed the way that people think about sex and sexuality and marriage, and that's obviously going to have an effect on distancing the young people from the old.
So when you were talking about coming out just then, did you mean those younger generation who were contemplating coming out to their parents?
Yeah, in my experience, I've spoken to people, as I say, in the 25 to 30 bracket who may have been thinking about whether it was important or not to come out to different people in their lives. Mm. And
as you said, it was so the idea of homosexuality or same-sex sexuality was something that their parents had sort of received, but they didn't think that it could happen to their own family. Is that kind of the gist that you're getting from them?
What I was basing my observations on was the fact that a few people said, there's no point. There's no point bringing that up with my parents. So, I mean, whether or not that meant that the parents thought that the concept didn't exist or not would be difficult to prove. All I'm basing my observations on are what a few people said, and it seems that the reason why they wouldn't bring that up with their parents is because there's no pragmatic use for it, in the sense that it may cause a lot more trouble than it's worth. Yeah,
Makes sense. So what other difficulties do young men who have sex with men in contemporary China face, other than should I come out or should I not come out?
Well, one of the interesting differences for me between the West and China is that you don't have gay bashing. So, I mean, we have a tendency, I think, to look at China as, I say we, I think British people in general, in a layman's sense, might think about China as hyper repressive and having an awful lot of trouble around issues like sexuality. But I think actually some of the differences between the West and China actually entail things which are easier for the Chinese population than they are for the Western, in the sense that, you know, explicit homophobia is not quite so prominent in China from my experience and from talking to the people that I talk to. Having said that, one of the major differences between China and the West is the incredible power of the family in Chinese context. So that's one of the struggles that a Chinese person faces. I think the issue of generally whether or not it's appropriate to talk about things that are sexual is also something which can be a struggle, not only for men who have sex with men, but for all kinds of young people in China. I think there's lots of research suggesting that talking about these things is a crucial way of coming to terms with them. And I think a lot of young people in China don't have the opportunity to do that, not only because sex education is dealt with very differently than it is in the West, but also because of cultural traditions of what you should and shouldn't talk about, not only to your teachers and to staff in institutions that you're part of, but also to your friends and to people around you. Again, those things are changing. I think the opportunities that young people have, especially in globally connected Eastern Chinese cities, to discuss and to be open about sexuality are increasing, but that doesn't immediately erode the huge power of tradition there in terms of leaving people alone and without anyone to talk these things through with. So yeah, in terms of the struggles that people are facing, I think those are the key ones: the influence of the family, the fact that there may be nobody to talk to. I guess another thing that really needs to be mentioned there also is the issue of HIV. When you have a culture where talking about sex is possibly not something that's encouraged, then talking about condoms is perhaps something that's not done very often either. So again, my research doesn't really go into HIV, but there's a huge amount of literature out there, both from China and from Western authors, talking about the problems of HIV in China and how they relate to culture and the way that people do and don't talk about sex.
And you mentioned differences in sex education as well, and I suspect that's related to the differences that you mentioned in the way that people talk about HIV or don't talk about HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases. Could you just explain a bit more about that?
I don't really know, again, about sexual education in any... I haven't done any research on that, but I understand that sex education in China doesn't have such a significant space in the timetable as it does in the West, for starters. That's one issue. The second issue, I think, is that teachers, some of my participants have told me that teachers are often very shy about these things, and even if the topics are on the subject, they might be glossed over in a class. They might be left behind. And although the role of the internet is hugely important in the changes that are happening in this, because young people do have access to go and find these things out themselves in recent years, which they didn't have before, I still think that the effect that the lack of sex education or effective sex education has on young people can be significant in terms of how they come to terms with who they are and in terms of their sex life, whether they happen to be gay or straight or any other sexual category.
Cool. Let's go back to marriage for a second. And you picked up in your research that a lot of gay and bisexual men enter into marriages of convenience. Is that essentially to sort of keep up the heterosexual norm?
Well, I'm currently doing my research on how many people are doing this, and it's not an easy thing to find out, but it seems from the number of press articles that have been released and the amount of chat that's going on in general about this particular topic, it seems like this is something which is happening a lot. It may have been something which happened in history in a much more covert way. But what's happening now is there's an explosion of websites and of talk about the subject of gay men marrying lesbians. There's lots of different names for it in Chinese, which is an interesting subject in itself. But certainly one of the main motivations, I think, for going on a website like this or finding a marriage partner in another way where there are two LGBT people involved is because of the fact that the heteronormative tradition exists, and the reason why people are doing this is to do what Chinese people should do, in the sense that they feel the weight of cultural tradition.
And do you see websites springing up that are kind of effectively matchmaking websites for LGBT people to enter into these marriages of convenience?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. I've come across a few of those, and the statistics that they show on their own websites in terms of how many matches they've made are quite astonishing. Whether or not they're true, I don't know, but from what you see on the internet when you look at these pages, it looks like there's an awful lot of people engaged in this process. And the reason why I'm focusing my PhD in this area is because it seems like there hasn't been a lot done in terms of going out and talking to these people and finding out what it's like for them, although there are some significant contributions to the literature. One particular paper from Korea, overall I think there's not a lot of concrete evidence out there showing that these things are happening and how they happen, which is why I'm going down that route.
Yeah. It's quite striking that you mentioned this kind of almost little cottage industry of matchmaking websites, because, you know, in Britain we're used to this kind of idea of the great firewall of China in you, and there's this sort of perception, rightly or wrongly, but I suspect there's some truth to that perception that the Chinese Communist Party has their eyes on everyone in terms of internet censorship. Is there any way of finding out whether the government actually has acknowledged these sites?
Well, I think the interesting thing that changed in terms of my perspective on the Chinese Communist Party between when I lived in Europe previously and when I lived in China was that they're not quite as all-encroaching as the average British person might imagine them to be. They certainly have a lot of influence on everyday life, but I think the things that they take action to repress and the things that they are concerned about are not necessarily as far-reaching as we here in Britain tend to think. And I think that sexuality in particular and a marriage aren't things that they would automatically go out of their way to try and suppress. So from my sort of the feeling I have about this is that this isn't something that they would feel the need to repress, actually.
Why not?
I don't feel like it sort of goes against any rules of the Communist Party's way of doing things. I think the Communist Party is certainly concerned about any challenges to the Communist Party, and that's one of the things they go out and do, but I don't think that... I mean, this is completely just going off gut feeling that I have.
Intuition.
Yeah, I've no idea. And it's an interesting question that you've raised there. It would be interesting to go out and find out what young people think in China about this, whether they think this is something which is socially acceptable or not, and particularly socially acceptable in the sense that it's sanctioned by the government or not. My gut feeling is that it's not a problem.
Mm. Or the government seems to be just neutral about it and just like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that the government doesn't suppress homosexual culture. By homosexual culture, I mean men who have sex with men having dating websites, for example, or having places that they can meet and socialise.
Like cruising spots and things like that.
Yeah, in general, is not something which is absolutely repressed. However, this is complicated because there are ways that Chinese policemen can close down and do close down gay bars and do go into cruising areas and harass people, or perhaps quite rightly arrest them for doing things which they shouldn't do. So, yeah, it's a complicated situation, I think. But the reason I brought that example up was because I think perhaps your average British person might expect that the whole idea of being gay in China might sort of cause a terrible commotion within the Communist Party, where they go out and shut everything down. But that's really not the case, and there is a huge space for gay men to be themselves, particularly on the internet, and to meet other gay men. And I think that's an example of how the Communist Party is perhaps not quite as concerned with things like sexuality as we might think.
That's actually really interesting. And there seems to be this tension between this kind of public acceptance of sex, in a way, in the public sphere, and yet in the private sphere, in the familial sphere, it's very much seen as a taboo.
Well, I think that goes back to what I was talking about earlier, in the sense that, you know, how much things are talked about is crucial here, because what you do outside of the sight of your family doesn't necessarily have to be talked about, you know. And there are quite interesting examples. Chou Hua-shan wrote a key text called Tong Zhi, which is all about the homosexual community in China, and he talks about ideas of families being quite accommodating to the idea of having, you know, another male friend, perhaps for their male son, who is very much involved in the family, and perhaps shares a room and a bed with the male son. But that wouldn't necessarily need to be something that was discussed in terms of what exactly was going on in that bed. So what I'm saying is there's sometimes a space within Chinese culture for homosocial behaviour not to be questioned. So certain things can be sort of, you know, unspoken, and that can fit into Chinese culture sometimes.
And those kinds of instances where, you know, male sons have male friends that they share beds with, they wouldn't have sexual connotations.
Well, no, that's exactly what I'm saying, is they could have in certain situations, and the to the extent where the parents might actually know that that's going on and turn a blind eye to it. And I think what I'm trying to highlight is the importance of what's allowed to be spoken about, what should be spoken about, what isn't spoken about in Chinese culture is different to what it is in the West, and that there's certain ways of sort of navigating that where you can come up with new models of doing things. And that's exactly what my research is about in terms of marriage, that, you know, it would be kind of bizarre for the same kind of thing to happen in the West. Like, okay, well, what, so lesbians marrying a gay, okay, is that really necessary? You know, I mean, come on, guys, you know, the gay guy can get married, the lesbian can get married. Why would you do that? But it's through understanding this the cultural context of China that I've started to realize just how different things are, and how there is a massive potential to carve interesting new cultural spaces within the way that the Chinese society works.
I mean, there is a history in, if you look at the homosexual subculture in Britain, of lavender marriages, of marriages of convenience, but in the 50s, 60s, or whatever, before homosexuality was sort of socially normalised. But I suspect that's kind of what's going on here, but at the same time, it's not the same thing as what's going on.
Yeah, well, again, that's not my area really to talk about Britain, because I don't really know that much about the way things used to work here. But I assume marriages of convenience have been part of British society for a long time too. I think what's interesting about the Chinese case is that just the explosion of facilitated by the internet of this kind of practice, and that being based on a cultural need that we don't really have in the West. You know, there's no necessity for young men to do that in order to satisfy the cultural expectations that they feel subject to.
The other thing, of course, is the legacies of the one child policy, and the fact that baby sons are much more preferred than baby daughters. So you've got this huge gender imbalance. Does that have consequences for these matchmaking websites? I.e., do you have straight women who can't find a partner going onto these matchmaking websites as well?
That's an interesting question. I have no idea the answer to that, but I'd certainly like to go out and ask that question. Who is using these websites precisely? I mean, what kind of people are they? Obviously, the only way to really find that out is to go and talk to them. So, obviously, the internet has the potential to allow you to express whichever aspects of yourself you want to, whether they're true or false. There may well be different types of people on there doing this for different reasons, and it would be interesting to talk to.
And how do kind of ideologies of masculinity and femininity fit into the Chinese conception of marriage in general, but also the way in which these marriages of convenience play out?
Well, I think one of the crucial aspects of Chinese masculinity that makes it distinct from the West is the ancient tradition of the effeminate scholar. The Western concept of masculinity is much more purely based in the idea of a physically strong male. And there's space within Chinese masculinity for two different models, one being similar to the Western one in that sense, and one being more based on being effeminate, slightly effeminate, and being a scholar. So if you're a wise man and you hold yourself in a certain way which would be considered effeminate in a Western context, that can still be considered as a representation of masculinity within the Chinese context. In terms of what effect that has on marriage, I guess it would be really interesting again to talk to people about how they see themselves and their roles within these marriages, because this makes me think of the lesbian community in particular, because they often have such very clearly defined roles within their relationship anyway. So in the Chinese context, you have these labels. So it would be ti and po. So ti representing tomboy originally, I believe. Again, I'm not an expert in this area, but and po being from the Chinese word for wife. So you've got these very gendered roles that exist in lesbian culture, and I understand that it's often one of the first questions that you're asked within a lesbian Chinese group of friends. You know, are you a ti or are you a po? You know, which category? Or I believe there's a mid category as well, which I don't know, shuang something.
So effectively, who does the washing up and who's the breadwinner?
Exactly. Yeah, and I wonder how these things pan out in terms of, you know, Xingxue Hunyin, so the new forms of cooperative marriage that are emerging, who takes which role in terms of masculinity and femininity. Obviously that depends on what category of gay man you are and what category of lesbian you are when you go into that. But that also opens up another really interesting area that I'm going to go into, which is how do the day-to-day steps of these arrangements pan out? I mean, are you going to have a child to please your parents when you're in one of these marriages? Are you going to live together? Are you going to have a second flat that you go to when your family's coming around, then go and do your own thing? You know, all of these questions of day-to-day difficulties that these people must have to go through, and I guess they probably negotiate them right at the start of the process as well. You know, it needs to be very clear between the two partners who's going to do what, who's going to pay for what, and you know, there's so many considerations in terms of how these things are going to work.
Inheritances and wills and so on and so forth. I take it you're a linguist by trade. A social linguist, if that's the right phrase. So what interests you about the kind of linguistic aspects of the discourses of marriage and brackets homosexuality?
Well, I could spend all day boring you with the theory on this kind of thing, but I think the basic underlying principle of what I do is linguistic ethnography. So going into a community and observing what the people do within that community, and in particular focusing on the language that they use, but not exclusively the language that they use. Everything else that they do is also important. And in doing linguistic ethnography, I'll be foregrounding the role of discourse. From when I talk about discourse, I mean the kind of Foucauldian sense of discourse, whereby we're talking about systems of knowledge that circulate via the use of language. So for somebody from this kind of research paradigm, there's an assumption that language and culture are inextricably linked, and the best way of finding out about those links and about how those links manifest themselves in different cultural contexts is to go and observe people, be involved in people's lives, and listen very carefully to how they speak, and watch everything else and listen to everything else that's going on around them to get a clear picture of what that cultural phenomenon that's being studied is all about.
Effectively being an anthropologist, I suppose.
Yeah, well, ethnography is a concept that comes from anthropology, and I think linguistic approaches to anthropology have certainly become more important over the last 50 years, and more and more important, and they've taken many more different forms. But the underlying principle being that, you know, you're interested in culture and the link between language and culture.
And what kinds of things does that reveal that are inverted commas ordinary anthropological analysis might not show?
Well, I think a linguistic anthropologist takes as a starting point the fact that language is important, and more important than a normal anthropologist, in inverted commas, might think it is. So I think that's the crucial difference, really, is that linguistic anthropologists would foreground the role of language in the processes of culture.
Okay, great. We've been talking so far about ideas and ideologies of marriage and sexuality, homosexuality in the Chinese context. What kind of space is there for LGBT rights discourse? And is that LGBT rights discourse seen as a Western imposition or something that's compatible with Chinese culture?
Well, I think there are two different types of voice that emerge on that particular issue. There are those that do advocate a very confrontational way of dealing with LGBT rights. And when I say confrontational, that's a kind of an approach that involves campaigning, that involves gay pride parades, that involves going out and making a case for LGBT rights in public.
And making a fuss about it,
yeah.
Quite deliberately.
Right, yes, and I think that's something which, you know, Western LGBT communities have emerged out of. I mean, we go back to the Stonewall riots in the USA and everything that's emerged from that, in the sense that we in the West, I think, have built the LGBT communities on the basis of this. But I think the role of individualism and collectivism is important here, because certain voices from within Chinese cultures would consider that way of going about bringing an LGBT discourse to the forefront doesn't really suit a Chinese context, because it's too individualistic and it's too combative and it's too confrontational. And again, going back to all those issues I was talking about earlier of when you should say something and when things should just be left because it's better for the group and it's more harmonious. You know, a key term in Chinese discourse is harmony, the promotion of harmony. And if that's going to be spoiled by, you know, protesting or by actively pursuing an LGBT agenda, then it doesn't fit for some Chinese people. And that's an interesting tension, because the way that people are going about being gay and campaigning for gay rights needs to take into account the cultural context, I think, and the Western influence is there, but I think it's not a model that can fit perfectly in the Chinese context, and it'd be interesting to see how that pans out.
There is this word that I think you used earlier, the idea tongzhi. Could you just gloss for our listeners what exactly that word connotes?
Okay, well, tongzhi has an interesting history. Tongzhi originally meant comrade, so it's a term of endearment between two people of any gender, which emerged during communist times. I think it was originally translated from Russian. So during the times of Chairman Mao, this would be the word that you used to say hello to a friend. Hi, mate, for example, in British or Australian English. So it has an interesting trajectory, this word, after that, because the two characters within that word, tongzhi, literally mean same spirit. Obviously, the same spirit that he originally intended was the spirit of communism. And this word was borrowed by the gay community. It's generally agreed that this happened around the 1980s in Hong Kong, first of all. And the reason why it was appropriated by gay groups in Hong Kong is exactly because of the significance of those two Chinese characters. The same spirit in this case, of course, being gay spirit, people being together in the sense that they're a gay community. So tongzhi is an interesting word in that sense. More recently, there have been certain sections of the LGBT community in Hong Kong and elsewhere who've rejected that term on the basis that it has a communist history, because of course the political tension between Hong Kong and mainland China is extremely important. So it's difficult to gloss tongzhi in a simple way, but if you want it in a simple term, it means gay, really, in the sense that it's one of the commonly used terms in the mainland China, and still to some extent in Hong Kong, I think, to refer to a gay man. And it's definitely falling out of popularity, I think. And the English word gay, or the transliteration of the English word gay, is becoming more prominent in terms of labels. This is an interesting study in itself, which terms are used and for which reasons by which groups. And obviously there may be some Chinese people who want to reject the word gay because of, in a similar way to tongzhi, it represents a particular group, that group being Westerners in this case, which Chinese people might want to define themselves against. So yeah, tongzhi basically means gay man.
And it specifically refers to, or it specifically has the connotation of male same-sex desire.
Yeah, so it means a gay man. It could also be used for a woman.
Okay, great. Yeah. And you mentioned sort of the prominence of gay transliterated in Chinese. Is that seen as a specifically westernized form of sexuality that goes along with that term?
Well, this is interesting, and it's a question that I asked in one of my previous research projects. And to what extent people see gay as a Western idea really varies depending on the particular person that you're talking to. And I think I carried out my research in Ningbo, which is a fairly big town, in an important town in China. It's a city, sorry. And with a mere 10 million people. So about the population of London, but still not one of the most important cities in China. And the reason I'm talking at length about the city is because it has an interesting mix of people in terms of their socioeconomic backgrounds. A huge amount of migrant workers, a huge amount of people who are well-educated and globally connected. And, you know, the answers that people give to questions like, what does gay mean to you? And are you gay or are you tongzhi? Really vary depending on not only their socioeconomic background, but which part of China they've grown up in, whether they've been overseas, what kind of internet access and films they have had in their life. All of these things make a difference. But I think gay certainly is used by some as a marker of prestige and a marker of cosmopolitanism, that's for sure. And I think not only from my research, but from people like Loretta Ho and Lisa Roffel, they've also pointed out that gay is a discourse which is often appropriated in a way that allows people to be globally connected, cosmopolitan people.
So what kinds of terms would people use that aren't as globally connected, that aren't as in tune with mainstream Western media?
Well, I think the other common term that we haven't talked about so far is tongxinglian, so literally same-sex love, which is a term which is more medicalized, more associated with disease and perversion, and a term that's going out of fashion for those reasons, but also still exists in the same way that the word homosexual is used in the West, for more sort of pragmatic descriptions of bodily functions, or perhaps, you know, it does exist still, although in the same way that homosexual has negative connotations, they exist for that word too. And there are a myriad of other terms that are emerging that are really quite interesting too. I mean, during the time that I was in China, the film Brokeback Mountain was out, and there's a lot of people referring to gays as Duan Bei, broke back.
Quite literally.
Yeah, and that was a playful thing that the young people were doing, and these labels, not necessarily always referring explicitly to men who have sex with men, but also in a sort of jovial way between young people making fun of each other, but then sometimes being appropriated by the community themselves. This, you know, there's all kinds of words like that, you know, rainbow, Tai Hong was another one that came up in my research. And more recently, there's a paper just been released recently, who I'm afraid I don't know the name of the author, but it was an excellent paper on this Gao Gay discourse, which was borrowed from Cantonese originally, and has become, and it was an internet meme that became popular among young people in mainland China recently. And originally was very derogatory in Cantonese, you know, literally meaning, you know, doing gay. It's used in a sort of jovial way amongst young people who may or may not be gay, or men who have sex with men. So, you know, the plethora of terms that exist in China, it's really fascinating. And I think things like tongxinglian are on the way out, and tongzhi too, to some extent. But how people move on after gay, the borrowing of gay, is quite interesting in terms of how they choose to represent themselves.
And do we see analogues of queer sort of springing up as well?
I think queer is one that doesn't seem to have caught on so well in China. I think there was in Taiwan more than anywhere else, there was a transliteration, queer, I think, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it, but that became prominent for some time. But I asked people in China about that one, in mainland China about that one, and it seemed like not many people were using that. I guess that one emerged so much out of the, you know, the queer movement in the West, which is so much, in my perspective, linked to academic discourse and, you know, advocacy and campaigning, that, you know, it sat very much, even in the West, in a very specific section of society. So I'm assuming that might be one reason why it's not been so popular in China, because it was so specific here to our cultural context and to our cultural needs at the time.
Yeah. Well, it's quite striking the fact that you've got all these kinds of terms springing up and this kind of identity politics that seems to be emerging in China that seems to be very much in tension with the traditional emphasis on the collective. And is that a tension that you see playing out in China?
Sorry, can you say that again?
Yeah, sure. So, with all these terms and the kind of the politicization of LGBT as an identity, it looks like there's this form of identity politics, this very kind of Western heritage identity politics, which is very much in tension with the Chinese emphasis on the collective. Does that suggest that identity politics is not compatible with the Chinese emphasis on the collective, or is it a meeting of the two, as it were?
Well, I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier, in the sense that you know, being confrontational and going out and talking about gay issues, you know, in a Chinese context, it's a tricky business, and how you define yourself is a crucial aspect of that, from my point of view as a linguistic anthropologist, and also as someone who's interested in identity terms and the power that defining yourself in a certain way has. And I think again, I don't really feel like I know the answer to that question, but I would like to find it out. You know, I'd like to talk to Chinese people about which terms they use and what they hope to get from using those terms, whether they be individuals or whether they be part of advocacy campaigns or anything else.
Okay, great. I think that's about almost all we have time for. Just a couple of last questions. Where do you see the trajectory of LGBT rights going in China? Is it definitely towards things like gay marriage, adoption, the kinds of things that we're sort of used to in the West by now, or is it sort of stuck?
Well, I think there are movements for gay marriage, for sure. Quite slow movements, but I think there are sort of legal cases that have been arising recently, and the sociologist Li Yinhe has been campaigning successively every year, sending huge surveys and lots of signatures to the government.
Like petitions.
Petitions, thanks. to keep putting pressure on the government in terms of same-sex marriage, and you know, so she's an academic, so there's academics and there's legal battles, and it's very much in the public eye at the moment, and it seems like, you know, at least there's discussion, and that can only be a positive thing. In terms of the young people I've spoken to in China, it seems like it's inevitable, really, that these things are going to be something which is not only talked about but practiced more widely in China in the fairly near future, I would think. But of course, they are up against the weight of tradition that we've been talking about, and you know, it's not an inevitable thing at all. But certainly, there's an increase in the amount of talk on the subject of gay marriage and of adoption, etc. And let's just hope that it ends up in a way which leads to people being able to live the lives that they want.
And we've been speaking about the weight of tradition all through this hour, but we haven't really touched on the subject of bisexuality and how sort of bisexuals fit into this kind of model. I mean, how much evidence is there for bisexuals entering into marriage as a convenience, for example?
Well, there's not really much evidence about anything to do with marriages of convenience as far as I can see.
Yeah.
So I guess this is something that people like me are going to go out and try and do. And in terms of the way bisexuals fit in, again, this is not something I can really comment on, but again, definitely an interesting question to ask. And thank you for bringing that up. Maybe that's something I should be asking when I go out and do my project. How do all varieties of you know, of sexual practice fit into these models?
Okay, great. As I say, I think that's about all we have time for. Thank you very much, Phil, for an absolutely fascinating discussion on a subject I think not many of us know enough about. I mean, we hear a lot about China in the news, but this kind of angle isn't addressed very much, and it's great to have someone like you come to the show to talk about it. And thank you, listeners, for joining me on another engaging hour on The Provocateur. I hope to see you again very soon, and metaphorically speaking, I hope to see you again very soon on another edition, where we'll be taking on another LGBT topic. You can find all the previous episodes at provocateurpodcast.com. And as I say, I hope to see you again very soon on another episode. You've been listening to Garke Leung and Philip Friesden. Thank you very much.